content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading from The Atlantic magazine. The first article is an edited version of the story, Can a Building Be Too Tall?, written by Bianca Bosker. And this is from the January-February 2023 issue of The Atlantic. It was a sunny day in New York City when I realized that my sky was being stolen. The first sign of trouble was the crane. Its thin finger appeared over the old brick building outside my window, scratching at the sliver of sky I could just make out above the rooftops. My sky. In a city where you can sprain your neck searching for sky, I relished this shard of blue, so tiny that I could cover it with my thumb. I consoled myself about the crane with the flimsy logic I once used after discovering a bedbug. It'll go away. It didn't. When the metal skeleton of a skyscraper materialized beneath the crane, I told myself that the new building would top out soon. It couldn't possibly get much taller. But the skeleton kept stretching. It rose above the brick building, then over the windows of neighboring apartments, walling off precious blue behind it. It was so tall, so thin, I began to doubt that the cross-hatching of metal beams could actually be a building. We're living through the birth of a new species of skyscraper that not even architects and engineers saw coming. After 9/11, experts concluded that skyscrapers were finished. Tall buildings that were in the works got scaled down or canceled on the assumption that soaring towers were too risky to be built or occupied. There were all sorts of symposiums and public statements that we're never going to build tall again, one former architect told The Guardian in 2021. All we've done in the 20 years since is build even taller. There are skyscrapers, and then there are super talls, often defined as buildings more than 300 meters in height, but better known as the cloud-puncturing sci-fi towers that look like digital renderings, even when you're staring at them from the sidewalk. The first super talls were impossible, then a rarity. Now they're all over the place. In 2019 alone, developers added more super talls than had existed prior to the year 2000. There are now a couple of hundred worldwide, including Dubai's 163-story Burj Khalifa, a hypodermic needle aimed at space, Tianjin's 97-floor CTF Finance Center, reminiscent of a drill bit boring the clouds, and, encroaching on my sky, Manhattan's 84-floor Steinway Tower, a luxury condominium resembling the love child of a dustbuster and a Mach 3 razor. Some supertalls have even a more futuristic designation, super slim. These buildings are alternately described as needle towers or toothpick skyscrapers, though not every super slim is a super tall. Early super slims shot up in Hong Kong in the 1970s, though lately they've become synonymous with New York City. Four super tall super slims loom over the southern end of Central Park in a stretch of Midtown known as Billionaire's Row. Building engineers, like judgy modeling agents, have varying definitions of super slim, but they usually agree that such buildings must have a height-to-width ratio of at least 10 to 1. To put that in perspective, the Empire State Building, one of the world's first super talls completed in 1931, is about three times taller than it is wide. Pudgy, as one engineer described it to me. Steinway Tower is 24 times taller than it is wide. Nearly as slim as a number two pencil. And the skinniest super tall in the world. The developer's official name for the building is 111 West 57th Street. These super slim buildings, and super talls generally, have relied on engineering breakthroughs to combat the perilous physics that go with height. A 2021 article in the journal Civil Engineering and Architecture declared, "There is no doubt that super tall, slender buildings are the most technologically advanced constructions in the world." High-rises have become so ubiquitous, it's easy to forget what a triumph it is to build even a humdrum office tower. For millennia, our ancestors inched slowly but steadily toward the clouds. Archaeologists have called the Tower of Jericho, completed about 10,000 years ago, the super skyscraper of its day. It reached a grand total of 28 feet. Around 2600 BC, the Great Pyramid of Giza broke records when it hit 480 feet, less than half the height of the Eiffel Tower. And humans took nearly 4,000 years to go higher. From the Tower of Jericho through the Industrial Revolution, there was basically one way to go high: stone. Traditionally, masonry walls supported a building's weight and structure, which curtailed their height. Going taller required thicker walls, which, beyond a certain point, risked monopolizing floor space and squeezing tenants into sunless cavities. The New York World Building, briefly the city's tallest in 1890, had some walls wider than a garbage truck. Steel skeletons sent us higher, to mixed reviews. As skyscrapers began appearing on the New York skyline at the turn of the century, back when skyscraper meant any building with more than a dozen floors, observers warned that these buildings were a menace to public health and safety that would surely collapse. The evolution of our nation's tallest structures can arguably be divided into three broad phases. First, the tallest buildings were built in honor of deities, then commerce, and now billionaires. If life in the clouds sounds tempting, allow me to direct your attention to the price tag. When 432 Park Avenue first went on the market in 2012, it offered a basement storage closet smaller than a parking spot for $198,000, more than the median price of a home in Des Moines, Iowa. At $169 million, its top-floor penthouse was, for a time, the most expensive listing in Manhattan. On a Tuesday morning in the fall of 2021, Volodymyr Tyrol took the elevator to the top floor of 432 Park Avenue, climbed the stairs to the roof, and while practically eye level with the Empire State's spire, went right over the side of his favorite building in the city. Tyrol, who scrutinized practically every square foot of 432 Park's exterior, was a window washer for 5 years. He now works in management for the same company. He is 27 years old, enjoys photography, and is scared of heights. Tyrol moved to New York in 2017 from Lviv, Ukraine, where he lived in a second-floor apartment from which he refused to look down. After arriving in the United States, he got a job cleaning windows. His boss considered his fear of heights an asset. He said, "We prefer to hire people who are afraid of heights," Tyrol recalled. "It means you're going to be more careful and more safe." Tyrol started low, but then began dangling off of many of New York's super talls. 432 is the first Tyrol ever cleaned, and he's since returned too many times to count. To get to work there, he propels himself up 1,400 feet into the air where, he says, "I feel like I wake up. When I see that view, I feel like power comes to me, like the whole power from the city comes to me." At 432 Park, Tyrol could wash about 100 windows a day. The whole building took about 2 weeks. Perhaps because window washers aren't allowed out on the scaffold when wind speeds exceed 25 miles an hour, Tyrol said he's never felt 432 Park move. Yet super talls not only ascend, they also sway, flutter, vibrate, bend, and lean, often a lot. Chicago's Willis Tower, which is more than 50 feet taller than 432 Park, can move up to 3 feet in strong winds. If you were to look down at the spire of a tall building during a windstorm, you'd see that it careens left, right, and around, like an inebriated giraffe. All of that motion can cause people to feel a little drunk themselves. Occupants of tall buildings have, in high winds, reported nausea, distractibility, difficulty working, and fatigue. The researchers report that skyscrapers rarely, if ever, induce vomiting. As winds howl, buildings can moan like creaky container ships or clatter like subway cars. No realtor would ever give a potential tenant a handbook that explains how these buildings behave because they wouldn't buy them, probably, says Peter Weissmantle, the director of Super Tall Building Technology for Adrian Smith Gordon Gill Architecture, which designed Central Park Tower. And yet some motion is safe and normal and often goes unnoticed. There is a cruel irony in getting lost trying to enter one of the most inescapable buildings in the skyline. Gazing up at 432 Park from down on the 57th Street, I could see Tyrol suspended along its facade. But for 15 minutes, I spent sprinting around in confusion. I couldn't find my way to the front door. I eventually discovered the lobby, which felt like the world's most glamorous airport lounge. It had never occurred to me that air could smell expensive, but the oxygen I inhaled felt high caliber. Perfect humidity, ideal temperature, with a freshness reminiscent of clean laundry. My host was Noel Burke, a real estate agent who deals in palatial Beaux Art townhouses and super luxury buildings. She was the exclusive broker for three different apartments for sale in 432 Park at the time, including number 79, which her listing describes as a masterpiece. The asking price is $135 million. I stepped into number 79, swapped my boots for beige slippers as Burke instructed, and gawked. You will notice that it's totally quiet. And still, Burke stressed. And they say the tall buildings are going to move. You don't feel that at all. I didn't. But wind speeds that afternoon were a listless 5 miles per hour. I'll confess that I probably dragged out the visit longer than I needed to. There is absolutely nothing that jars your mind in this apartment, Burke said. You take a person that has a high-pressure job, and they're crazed all day. They come here, and there's a calmness that settles their whole body. In each room, we pause to contemplate the skyline. The Metropolitan Museum of Art looked like a Ritz cracker from this angle, while Manhattan's most eye-catching skyscrapers, the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, One Vanderbilt, were lined up like shots on a bar. Burke inventoried each vista. That's Staten Island, and that's Brooklyn. Then you see all the bridges, as though the city's landmarks were amenities included with the apartment. You get fine wine, a sushi bar, a wine refrigerator, and Long Island City. As my time in number 79 stretched, I realized it was the longest I'd ever gone without hearing honks or sirens in the city. In the living room, I felt momentarily disoriented. What city is this again? I felt like I could be anywhere. You don't have to leave the building for anything, Burke told me. These buildings you could come live in for the rest of your life and be taken care of. Except eventually, I did want to leave. When I finally descended back to the sidewalk, I went home in a daze, as though I had just returned from a trip out of town. I took the long route back to the subway, immersing myself in the chaos of the streets. Next, from the December 2022 issue, this is an edited version of Bono's Great Adventure, written by David Brooks. If you don't know, Bono is the stage name of Paul David Hewson, the lead singer of the Irish rock band U2. Bono was 14 when his grandfather died. His family was at the cemetery burying him when his mother, Iris, fainted. His father, Bob, and his older brother, Norman, took her to the hospital to have her checked out, and Bono went over to his grandmother's house where the family was gathering. A little while later, one of his uncles burst in wailing, "Iris is dying! Iris is dying! She's had a stroke!" It was at that instant, Bono says, that his home disappeared. A hole opened up within him. Bono is now 62 and reflecting on how many rock stars lost their mother at a crucial age. John Lennon, Johnny Rotten, Bob Geldof, Paul McCartney. The list of the abandoned goes on and on. Their mother's deaths left them with this bottomless craving. People who need to be loved at scale, with 20,000 people screaming your name every night, are generally to be avoided, Bono says with a laugh. My kind of people. His mother lingered on for a few days after the stroke. Bono and his brother were ushered into her hospital room, and they held her hands while the machine keeping her alive was flicked off. Then Bono, his father, and brother returned home and almost never spoke of her again. They barely even thought of her, at least for years. "It's not just she's dead. We disappeared her," Bono says. His father sunk into opera. He would stand in front of their stereos, surrounded by the strains of La Traviata, lost to the rest of the world. Bono would watch him, unable to get to him. "He doesn't notice that I'm in the room looking at him," Bono writes in Surrender, his entrancing new memoir. His father had a beautiful tenor voice, but protected himself from disappointment by not allowing himself any dreams about a musical career. And then his great regret in life was that he didn't have the courage to try to pursue one. No wonder music would be exactly the thing Bono would want to go to succeed where his father didn't, to make his father see him. There's a little bit of patricide in the book, he admits to me. If you ask yourself the question, how would you take this man down? The answer would become the tenor that he wished to be. Of course. I tell you all of this because there is something about Bono I'm trying to understand. I call it his muchness. There's just a lot to the guy, so much driven energy, intensity, so much sensitivity, anger, joy, and propulsive energy. If you watch U2 perform, you see three guys playing their instruments in a cool, understated way, and then this short, crazy Irishman climbing frantically around the stage. Spend any time with him off stage, and he is fantastically entertaining, filling every room with stories and argument. He's a maximalist at nearly everything he does. Musically and in his activist life, Bono exhibits a pattern of overreaching, his lofty goals sometimes exceeding his grasp. One grand project after another, gigantic concert tours, economic development in Africa, addressing the AIDS crisis. Perhaps the source of Bono's energy and unrelenting drive may not be scarcity, but abundance. The guy had a rotten childhood, but since then he has been blessed with just about everything life can offer. Perhaps he is simply maniacally excited to take advantage of it all. While I spent a few days with him in Dublin this fall, an old book came to mind. It was an analysis of American culture called People of Plenty by the late historian David Potter. The core argument made by the school of historians Potter belonged to is that America's natural character is defined by abundance. The European settlers who first came to the country found forests stretching on forever, flocks of geese so large they required 30 minutes to take off. All of this possibility drove the settlers sort of mad. They found themselves walking more in a day than they had ever imagined, dreaming dreams bigger than they had ever imagined. These immigrants, the ones who weren't brought here in chains, turned entrepreneurial, disordered, antic, religiously zealous, morally charged, messianic, and perpetually restless. They measured their life by how much they had grown and how far they had climbed. They were propelled by a central contradiction. They had this intense spiritual drive to complete God's plan for humanity on this continent, and they also had this fevered ambition to get really rich. They were propelled by a moral materialism that would never let them rest. One day I was riding around Dublin with Bono in a tiny Fiat, and the thought occurred to me, Bono's a little like this. He may be Irish, but he's got a lot of that loud American go-go type in him. Part Messiah, part showman. We are sitting in Mount Temple, the school he attended during his teenage years. It is a generic and tattered building, as generic and a tattered building as you can imagine. Walls of cinder block painted bright colors. It was built by the World Bank at a time when Ireland still was the kind of poor country that depended on the World Bank. Bono shows me the bulletin board where Larry Mullen Jr. tacked a notice that read, "Drummer seeks musicians to form band," the notice that produced U2. Bono shows me the music room where U2 first practiced together. It's just a bunch of high school chairs and desks. "Something happened here," Bono says. "Something was going on." It certainly was, and if certainly did. You can source Bono's life to the psychic loss of his parents, or you can source to what came next. Bono may have been a basket case at 14, but by 18 he had found the five people whom he would spend the rest of his life with: Jesus Christ, his wife Ollie, and his bandmates Mullen, Adam Clayton, and David Evans, and he met them all at this school. He joined his band and started dating his wife in the exact same week. For a teenager who seems to be drowning, he did a fantastic job of finding companions for life. Who manages to do all that by age 18? The boys formed their band, went through the hard apprenticeship of rejection that all teenage bands go through, and then finally got to make an album, Boy. Most rock albums, especially in those days, were about rebellion, coming of age, savvy knowingness, but this was an album about innocence, about seeing with the eyes of a child. U2 was announcing that the band was going to be in this world, but not of it. From the first album, U2's strengths were evident. Where others would hear harmony or counterpoint, Bono writes, I was better at finding the top line in the room, the hook, the clear thought. Through the next couple of decades, the band turned out hit after hit, and although Bono is always saying how punk he is, I just hear popular mainstream rock, With or Without You, Where the Streets Have No Name, Beautiful Day. The band's other great strength is the pseudo-religious power of their concerts. Bono was influenced by an obscure book called The Death and Resurrection Show, From Shaman to Superstar, by Rogan P. Taylor, which argues that modern performance culture has its ancient roots in shamanism. When we go to a concert, we enter the presence of a mystic who interacts with the spirit world and brings the spiritual energies into the physical one. We're religious people when we're not. We find ritual and ceremony powerful, Bono says. We were always interested in the ecstatic. I think our music reflects that. Boy was a success and the band was on its way, but then The Edge, the lead guitarist, declared that he needed to quit. He told Bono he didn't see how they could be both believers and in a band. He didn't see how they could be global stars and fulfill the humbler calling to serve a local community. The world was so broken and needed love. What good could a few songs do? Bono, experiencing some of the same doubts, replied, If you're out, I'm out. Their manager, Paul McGinnis, who had just signed a bunch of contracts for their coming tour, was astounded. Am I to gather from this that you have been talking with God? He asked skeptically. Yes. Do you think God would have you break a legal contract? But it was something else that really kept the band together. The Edge began to write Sunday Bloody Sunday, calling for an end to sectarian violence in Northern Ireland. With that song, you too saw how rock could be not just an expression of what was going on in their lives, but a vehicle to help a broken world. They would be missional or not at all. Bono's memoir can be read as a spiritual adventure story, a pilgrim's progress with super yachts and supermodels, or as Bono jokes, the pilgrim's lack of progress. On the one hand, it is called surrender, and this act of surrendering himself to higher love remains a guiding hope in his life. I'd always be the first up when there was an altar call, the come to Jesus moment, he writes in the book. I still am. If I was in a cafe right now and someone said, stand up if you're ready to give your life to Jesus, I'd be the first to my feet. I took Jesus with me everywhere, and I still do. I never left Jesus out of the most banal or profane actions of my life. On the other hand, he also walks around with the most gargantuan worldly ambitions burning in his chest. From the beginning, Bono wanted U2 to be like the Beatles and the other great bands. Megalomania started at a very early age, he jokes. It's unbelievable, God Almighty. All these decades, Bono and his bandmates have been relentlessly chasing the perfect rock and roll album, the perfect show. He now admits this often made him impossible. Throughout the years, Bono insisted that U2 produce a new sound with every album, as the Beatles had. In the book, he describes U2's creative process in great detail, and it's basically a series of scenes in which Bono is haranguing his mates. Too familiar. Making a band, breaking a band, remaking a band. Three things save him. The first is his wife, Ali. She is the star of the memoir, Light and Warmth, solidly grounded, deeply sold. Ali's the one who tells him when he's becoming too self-serious and losing his sense of mischief. She's his emotional foundation and spiritual partner. Their home near Dublin has a gigantically long table made from a tree trunk that hosts dinners of 20 to 30 people with dancing, drinking, and arguing about world affairs past 1 a.m. The place has the spirit of a perfect Irish pub. It turns out I'm oriented toward horizontal relationships rather than vertical ones, he says. His home is communal. His band is communal. His philanthropic work is communal. His life is rooted in peer relationships. The second thing that saves him is his activism. About a decade ago, I went to a U2 concert. As I drove home, one of Bono's people called me and asked if I wanted to hang out with him at his hotel. This is my dream, hanging out with a rock star after a concert. I got to the hotel bar, and there was Bono, an archbishop, some World Bank economists, and a West African government official. We ended up talking about developing world debt obligations until early in the morning. He may be a mystic shaman on the concert stage, but his view of social change is unromantic. He knows that it starts with relentless pressure. One day, Bono was haranguing George W. Bush because AIDS medications weren't getting to Africa fast enough. Finally, Bush interrupted him. Can I speak? I am the president. It's about long, tiring negotiations and compromise. Stale coffee and, as he puts it, damp cheese plates, soggy sandwiches late in the night. And it's about rejecting fundamentalism in all its forms, religious or ideological. Stay flexible, make constant, steady progress. Bono is often teased about his activism. I'm going to save the world, and I don't care how many magazine covers I have to be on to do it. But this work has been a useful unfolding of his faith. Your faith is an action, he tells me. Preach the gospel, but only use words if absolutely necessary. His activism has been a way he can take the fame of life that life gave him and turn it into a useful currency. I hope God is with us in our mansions on the hill or holiday homes by the sea, he writes. I know God is with the poorest and the most vulnerable. The ending of his book is a beautiful evocation of peace, a riotous man's homage to stillness. He writes the book in lyrics, not paragraphs. The wound of my teenage years had become an opening, is now closed. The search for home is now over. It is you. I am home, no longer in exile. Can a guy like Bono really achieve stillness, especially when he has so much yet to say? It's hard to know the answer to that. At one point, he told me that throughout his whole life, he'd been searching for home, and lately, he has come to realize that home is not a place, but a person. I neglected to ask the follow-up question. Is that person Ali? Jesus? Any random soul he happens to be in front of that day? Maybe all of the above. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.